Welcome, dear listener, to Wildflower Tales, the podcast that shares hidden gems in literature, written by women authors, names familiar and ones that should be. These remarkable women authors, like resilient wildflowers, defied societal norms and flourished on their own terms. I'm your host, Jenny Dallin, and I'm delighted to share these women and their stories with you. I'm a big fan of the classic tales and lore podcasts, as well as old-time radio dramas, and they inspired me to create this podcast, which shares both tales considered classic literature and what was popular fiction of the time. Today, we have a captivating journey ahead as we delve into Amelia B. Edwards' enigmatic short story from 1918, The 1415 Express. Amelia Edward was born in 1831 in London and was a writer from a very early age. Her first published poem appeared at age 7, her first published story at age 12. Throughout her writing career, Amelia published poetry, stories, articles in a number of magazines. She also wrote for newspapers, and even her novels were well received. Her last novel, in fact, Lord Brackenbury, from 1880, was a great success and had 15 press runs. Not only was Amelia a great writer, but she enjoyed travel, and a voyage up the Nile changed her life profoundly. Not only did it result in her still popular book, 1,000 Miles Up the Nile, but from this point forward in her life, she devoted herself exclusively to ancient Egyptian heritage and earned herself the nickname the Godmother of Egyptology. But we are not off to Egypt today with Amelia, but rather to Eastern England. So sit back, relax, and let's board the train with Mr. Langford into this remarkable, haunting tale. The 4:15 Express. The events which I am about to relate took place between 9 and 10 years ago. Sebastopol had fallen in the early spring. The Peace of Paris had been concluded since March. Our commercial relations with the Russian Empire were but recently renewed, and I, returning home after my first northward journey since the war, was well pleased with the prospect of spending the month of December under the hospitable and thoroughly English roof of my excellent friend Jonathan Jelf, Esquire of Demolton Manor, Clayborough, East Anglia. My way lay by the great East Anglian line, as far as Clayborough Station, where I was to be met by one of the Dumbleton carriages and conveyed across the remaining 9 miles of country. Having arrived some 7 minutes before the starting of the train, and by the connivance of the guard, taken sole possession of an empty compartment, I lighted my traveling lamp, made myself particularly snug, and settled down to the undisturbed enjoyment of a book and a cigar. Great, therefore, was my disappointment when, at the last moment, a gentleman came hurrying along the platform, glanced into my carriage, opened the locked door with a private key, and stepped in. It struck me at the first glance that I had seen him before. A tall, spare man, thin-lipped, light-eyed, with the ungraceful stoop in the shoulders, and scant gray hair worn somewhat long upon the collar. He carried a light waterproof coat, an umbrella, and a large brown Japan deed box, which last he placed under the seat. I now recognized my companion. I had met him, as I distinctly remembered, some 3 years before, at the very house for which, in all probability, he was now bound like myself. His name was Drury House. He was a lawyer by profession, and if I was not greatly mistaken, was first cousin to the wife of my host. I thought, observing him by the vague mixture of lamplight and twilight, that Mrs. Jelf's cousin looked all the worse for the 3 years' wear and tear which had gone over his head since our last meeting. He was very pale and had a restless light in his eye that I did not remember to have observed before. The anxious lines, too, about his mouth were deepened, and there was a cavernous, hollow look about his cheeks and temples, which seemed to speak of sickness or sorrow. When he had glanced at me for the third or fourth time, I ventured to address him. "Mr. John Drury House, I think.
That is my name."
I had the pleasure of meeting you at Dumbleton about 3 years ago. I thought I knew your face, but your name, I regret to say. Langford, William Langford. I have known Jonathan Jelf since we were boys together at Merchant Taylor's, and I generally spend a few weeks at Dumbleton in the shooting season. I suppose we are bound for the same destination? Not if you are on your way to the manor. I am traveling upon business. You have heard, perhaps, that we are to construct a branch line from Blackwater to Stockbridge. You are an East Anglian director, I presume. My interest in the company is threefold. I am a director, I am a considerable shareholder, and as the head of the firm of Drury House and Craig, I am the company's principal solicitor. Loquacious, self-important, full of his pet project, and apparently unable to talk on any other subject, Mr. Drury House then went on to tell of the opposition he had encountered and the obstacles he had overcome in the cause of the Stockbridge branch. I was entertained with a multitude of local details and local grievances. The rapacity of one squire, the impracticality of another, the indignation of the rector whose glebe was threatened, and so on and on and on, until my head ached and my attention flagged, and my eyes kept closing in spite of every effort that I made to keep them opened. At length I was roused by these words. £75,000 cash down. £75,000 cash down. That is a heavy sum.
A heavy sum to carry here,
replied Mr. Drury House, pointing significantly to his breast pocket,
but a mere fraction of what we shall ultimately have to pay.
You do not mean to say that you have £75,000 at this moment upon your person?
My good sir, have I not been telling you so for the last half hour? That money has to be paid over at 8:30 this evening at the office of Sir Thomas's solicitors on completion of the deed of sale.
But how will you get across by night from Blackwater to Stockbridge with £75,000 in your pocket?
To Stockbridge? I thought I'd explain how the sum only carries us as far as Mallingford, the first stage, as it were, of our journey, and how our route from Blackwater to Mallingford lies entirely through Sir Thomas Little's property.
I beg your pardon. I fear my thoughts were wandering. So you only go as far as Mallingford tonight?
Precisely. I shall get a conveyance from the Blackwater Arms. And you?
Oh, Jeff sends a trap to meet me at Clayborough. Can I be the bearer of any message from you?
You may say, if you please, Mr. Langford, that I wished I could have been your companion all the way, and that I will come over, if possible, before Christmas.
Nothing more?
Well, you may tell my cousin that she need not burn the hall down in my honor this time, and that I shall be obliged if she will order the blue room chimney to be swept before I arrive.
That sounds tragic. Had you a conflagration on the occasion of your last visit to Dumbleton?
Something like that. There had been no fire lighted in my bedroom since the spring. The flue was foul, and the rooks had built in it. So when I went up to dress for dinner, I found the room full of smoke and the chimney on fire.
Are we all ready at Blackwater? The train had generally come to a pause where Mr. Drury House was speaking, and putting my head out of the window, I could see the station some few hundred yards ahead. There was another train before us blocking the way, and the guard was making use of the delay to collect the Blackwater tickets. I had scarcely ascertained our position when the ruddy-faced official appeared at our carriage door.
"Tickets, sir?"
"I am for Clayborough," I replied, holding out the tiny pink card. He took it, glanced at it by the light of his little lantern, gave it back, looked, as I fancied, somewhat sharply at my fellow traveler, and disappeared. He did not ask for yours.
They never do. They all know me, and of course I travel free.
Blackwater! Blackwater!
Mr. Drury House pulled out his deed box, put his traveling cap in his pocket, resumed his hat, took down his umbrella, and prepared to be gone.
Many thanks, Mr. Langford, for your society. I wish you a good evening.
Good evening, I replied, putting out my hand. But he either did not see it or did not choose to see it, and slightly lifting his hat, stepped out upon the platform. Having done this, he moved slowly away and mingled with the departing crowd. Leaning forward to watch him out of sight, I trod upon something which proved to be a cigar case. It had fallen, no doubt, from the pocket of his waterproof coat, and was made of a dark Morocco leather, with a silver monogram upon the side. I sprang out of the carriage just as the guard came to lock me in. "Is there 1 minute to spare? The gentleman who traveled down with me from town has dropped his cigar case. He is not yet out of station."
"Just 1.5 minutes, sir. You must be quick."
I dashed along the platform as fast as my feet could carry me. It was a large station, and Mr. Dreeryhouse had by this time got more than halfway to the farther end. I, however, saw him distinctly, moving slowly with the stream. Then, as I drew nearer, I saw that he had met some friend, that they were talking as they walked, that they presently fell back somewhat from the crowd and stood aside in earnest conversation. I made straight for the spot where they were waiting. There was a vivid gas jet just above their heads, and the light fell full upon their faces. I saw both distinctly, the face of Mr. Dreeryhouse and the face of his companion. Running, breathless, eager as I was, getting in the way of porters and passengers, and fearful ever instant lest I should see the train going on without me, I yet observed that the newcomer was considerably younger and shorter than the director, that he was sandy-haired, mustached, small-featured, and dressed in a close-cut suit of Scotch tweed. I was now within a few yards of them. I ran against a stout gentleman. I was nearly knocked down by a luggage truck. I stumbled over a carpet bag. I gained the spot just as the driver's whistle warned me to return. To my utter stupefaction, they were no longer there. I had seen them but 2 seconds before, and they were gone. I stood still. I looked to right and left. I saw no sign of them in any direction. It was as if the platform had gaped and swallowed them. "There were two gentlemen standing here a moment ago. Which way could they have gone?" I said to a porter at my elbow.
"I saw no gentlemen, sir."
The whistle shrilled out again. Guard, far up on the platform, held up his arm and shouted to me, "Come on!"
"If you're going on by this train, sir, you must run for it."
I did run for it, and just gained the carriage as the train began to move, was shoved in by the guard, and left breathless and bewildered, with Mr. Dreeryhouse's cigar case still in my hand. It was the strangest disappearance in the world. It was like a transformation trick in a pantomime. They were there one moment, palpably there, talking, with the gaslight full upon their faces, and the next moment they were gone. There was no door near, no window, no staircase. It was a mere slip of barren platform, tapestried with big advertisement. Could anything be more mysterious? It was not worth thinking about, and yet, for my life, I could not help pondering upon it. Pondering, wondering, conjecturing, turning it over and over in my mind, and beating my brains for a solution of the enigma. I thought of it all the way from Blackwater to Clayborough. I thought of it all the way from Clayborough to Dumbleton, as I rattled along the smooth highway in a trim dog cart, drawn by a splendid black mare and driven by the silentest and dapperest of East Anglian grooms. We did the 9 miles in something less than an hour, and pulled up before the lodge gates just as the church clock was striking 7:30. A couple of minutes more, and the warm glow of the lighted hall was flooding out upon the gravel. A hearty grasp was on my hand, and a clear, jovial voice was bidding me, "Welcome to Dumbleton." I am not going to describe either the guests or the dinner that night. All provincial parties bear the strictest family resemblance, and I am not aware that an East Anglian banquet offers any exception to the rule. There was the usual country baronet and his wife. There were the usual country parsons and their wives. There was the sempiternal turkey and haunch of venison. Vanitas vanitatum. There is nothing new under the sun. At length, there came a pause. The entrees had just been removed, and the turkey had come upon the scene. The conversation had all along been of the languidest, but at this moment it happened to have stagnated altogether. Moved by an unlucky impulse, I thought I would relate my adventure. "By the way, Jelf, I came down part of the way today with a friend of yours." "Indeed, with whom, I pray?" said the master of the feast, slicing scientifically into the breast of the turkey. "He was no less a person than your wife's cousin, Mr. John Dreeryhouse." Mr. Jonathan Jelf laid down his knife and fork. Mrs. Jelf looked at me in a strange, startled way, and said never a word. "And he desired me to tell you, my dear madam, that you need not take the trouble to burn down the hall in his honor this time, but only to have the chimney of the blue room swept before his arrival." Before I had reached the end of my sentence, I became aware of something ominous in the faces of the guests, I felt I had said something which I had better have left unsaid, and that for some unexplained reason my words had evoked a general consternation. I sat confounded, not daring to utter another syllable, and for at least 2 whole minutes there was dead silence round the table. The guests hitherto had been simply dull, but now they were evidently uncomfortable and embarrassed. The dessert had scarcely been placed upon the table when the ladies left the room. I seized the opportunity to select a vacant chair next to a certain Captain Pendergrass.
In heaven's name, what was the matter just now? What had I said?
You mentioned the name of John Dreeryhouse.
What of that? I had seen him not 2 hours before.
It is a most outstanding circumstance that you should have seen him. Are you sure it was he?
As sure as my own identity. We were talking all the way between London and Blackwater. Well, why does that surprise you?
Because John Dreeryhouse absconded 3 months ago with £75,000 of the company's money and has never been heard of since.
John Dreeryhouse had absconded 3 months ago, and I had seen him only a few hours back? John Dreeryhouse had embezzled £75,000 of the company's money, yet told me that he carried that sum upon his person? Were ever facts so strangely incongruous, so difficult to reconcile? How should he have ventured again into the light of day? How dared he show himself along the line? Above all, what had he been doing throughout those mysterious 3 months of disappearance? Perplexing questions, these. Questions which at once suggested themselves to the minds of all concerned, but which admitted of no easy solution. I could find no reply to them. Captain Pendergrass had not even a suggestion to offer. Jonathan Jelf, who seized the first opportunity of drawing me aside and learning all that I had to tell, was more amazed and bewildered than either of us. He came to my room that night when all the guests were gone, and we talked the thing over from every point of view, without, it must be confessed, arriving at any kind of conclusion.
I do not ask you whether you have mistaken your man. That is impossible.
As impossible as that I should mistake some stranger for yourself.
It is not a question of looks or voice, but a fact. That he should have alluded to the fire in the blue room is proof enough of John Drury's house identity.
How did he look?
Older, I thought. Considerably older, paler, and more anxious. He has had enough to make him look anxious anyhow, be he innocent or guilty.
I am inclined to believe that he is innocent. He showed no embarrassment when I addressed him, and no uneasiness when the guard came round. His conversation was open to a fault. I might almost say that he talked too freely of the business which he had in hand.
That again is strange, for I know no one more reticent on such subjects.
He actually told you that he had £75,000 in his pocket.
He did.
Huh, my wife has an idea about it, and she may be right.
What idea?
Well, she fancies. Women are so clever, you know, at putting themselves inside people's motives. She fancies that he was tempted, that he did actually take the money, and that he had been concealing himself these 3 months in some wild part of the country, struggling possibly with his conscience all the time, and daring neither to abscond with his booty nor to come back and restore it.
But now that he has come back?
That is the point. She conceives that he has probably thrown himself upon the company's mercy, made restitution of the money, and, being forgiven, is permitted to carry the business through as if nothing had happened.
The last is an impossible case. Mrs. Jelf thinks like a generous and delicate-minded woman, but not in the least like a board of railway directors. Would never carry forgiveness so far.
I fear not, and yet is the only conjecture that bears a semblance of likelihood. However, we can run over to Clayborough tomorrow and see if anything is to be learned.
By the way, Pendergrass tells me you picked up his cigar case.
I did so, and here it is.
Jelf took the cigar case, examined it by the light of the lamp, and said at once that it was beyond doubt Mr. Dreeryhouse's property, and that he remembered to have seen him use it. Here, too, is his monogram on the side, the big J, transfixing a capital D. He used to carry the same on his notepaper.
It offers, at all events, a proof that I was not dreaming.
Aye. but it is time you were asleep and dreaming now. I am ashamed to have kept you up so long. Good night.
Good night, and remember that I am more than ready to go with you to Clayborough, or Blackwater, or London, or anywhere if I can be of the least service.
Thanks. I know you mean it, old friend, and it may be that I shall put you to the test. Once more, good night.
So we parted for that night and met again in the breakfast room at 8:30 the next morning. It was a hurried, silent, uncomfortable meal. None of us had slept well, and all were thinking of the same subject. Then 20 minutes after we left the breakfast table, the dog cart was brought round, and my friend and I were on the road to Clayborough.
Tell you what it is, Langford. I do not much fancy to bring up Drury House's name at Clayborough. All the officials know that he is my wife's relation, and the subject just now is hardly a pleasant one. If you don't mind much, we'll take the 11:10 to Blackwater. It's an important station, and we shall stand a far better chance of picking up information there than at Clayborough.
So we took the 11:10, which happened to be an express, and arriving at Blackwater about 12:15, proceeded at once to prosecute our inquiry. We began by asking for the station master, a big, blunt, businesslike person who had once averred that he knew Mr. John Druryhouse perfectly well, and there was no director on the line whom he had seen and spoken to so frequently.
He is not known to have been down the line any time yesterday, for instance.
The station master shook his head.
The East Anglian, sir, is about the last place where he would dare to show himself. Why, there isn't a station master, there isn't a guard, there isn't a porter who doesn't know Mr. Druryhouse by sight, as well as he knows his own face in the looking-glass, or who wouldn't telegraph for the police as soon as he had set eyes on him at any point along the line. Bless you, sir, there's been a standing order out against him ever since the 25th of September last.
Can you tell me who took the Blackwater tickets of the train?
I can, sir. Was the guard, Benjamin Somers.
And where can I find him?
You can find him, sir, by staying there, if you please, till 1 o'clock. He will be coming through with the up express from Crampton, which stays at Blackwater for 10 minutes.
We waited for the up express, beguiling the time as best we could by strolling along the Blackwater Road till we came almost to the outskirts of the town, from which the station was distant nearly 2 miles. By 1 o'clock we were back again upon the platform and waiting for the train. It came punctually, and I at once recognized the ruddy-faced guard who had gone down with my train the evening before.
The gentleman want to ask you something about Mr. Druryhouse, Somers.
The guard flashed a keen glance from my face to Jelf's and back again to mine.
Mr. John Druryhouse, the late director. Mr. John Druryhouse, the late director?
The same. Should you know him if you saw him?
Anywhere, sir.
Do you know if he was in the 4:15 express yesterday afternoon?
He was not, sir.
How could you answer so positively?
Because I looked into every carriage and saw every face in that train, and I could take my oath that Mr. Druryhouse was not in it. This gentleman was. I don't know that I ever saw him in my life before, but I remember his face perfectly. You nearly missed taking your seat in time at this station, sir, and you got out of Clayborough.
Quite true, guard, but do you not also remember the face of the gentleman who travelled down in the same carriage with me as far as here?
It was my impression, sir, that you travelled down alone.
By no means. I had a fellow traveller as far as Blackwater, and it was in trying to restore him the cigar case which he had dropped in the carriage, that I so nearly let you go on without me.
I remember you saying something about a cigar case, certainly, but...
You asked for my ticket just before we entered the station.
I did, sir.
Then you must have seen him. He sat in the corner next the very door to which you came.
No, indeed. I saw no one.
I looked at Jelf. I began to think the guard was in the ex-director's confidence and paid for his silence.
If I had seen another traveller, I should have asked for his ticket. Did you see me ask for his ticket, sir?
I observed that you did not ask for it, but he explained that by saying, I hesitated. I feared I might be telling too much, and so broke off abruptly. The guard and the station manager exchanged glances. The former looked impatiently at his watch.
I'm obliged to go on in 4 minutes more, sir.
One last question, then. If this gentleman's fellow traveller had been Mr. John Druryhouse, and you had been sitting in the corner next to the door by which you took the ticket,
Could you have failed to see and recognize him?
No, sir, it would have been quite impossible.
And you are certain you did not see him?
And as I said before, sir, I could take my oath I did not see him. This gentleman was quite alone in the carriage the whole way from London to Clayborough.
Why, sir, you expressly asked me to give you a compartment to yourself, and I did so.
I locked you in, and you were so good as to give me something for myself.
Yes, but Mr. Dreeryhouse had a key of his own.
I never saw him, sir. I saw no one in that compartment but yourself. Beg pardon, sir. My time's up.
And with this, the ruddy guard touched his cap and was gone. In another minute, the heavy panting of the engine began afresh, and the train glided slowly out of the station. We looked at each other for some minutes in silence. I was the first to speak. Mr. Benjamin Summers knows more than he chooses to tell.
Huh, do you think so?
It must be. He could not have come to the door without seeing him. It's impossible.
There is one thing not impossible, my dear fellow.
What is that?
That you may have fallen asleep and dreamed the whole thing.
Could I dream of a branch line that I never heard of? Could I dream of 101 business details that had no kind of interest for me? Could I dream of the 75,000 pounds?
Perhaps you might have seen or heard some vague account of the affair while you were abroad. It might have made no impression upon you at the time. It might have come back to you in your dreams, recalled perhaps by the mere names of the stations on the line.
What about the fire in the chimney of the Blue Room? Should I have heard of that during my journey?
Well, no, I admit there is a difficulty about that point.
And what about the cigar case?
Ah, by Jove, there is the cigar case. That is a stubborn fact. Well, it's a mysterious affair, and we'll need a better detective than myself, I fancy, to clear it up. I suppose we may as well go home.
A week had not gone by when I received a letter from the secretary of the East Anglian Railway Company requesting the favor of my attendance at a special board meeting not that many days distant. No reasons were alleged, and no apologies offered for this demand upon my time, but they had heard, it was clear, of my inquiries about the missing director, and had a mind to put me through some sort of official examination upon the subject. Being still a guest of Dumbleton Hall, I had to go up to London for the purpose, and Jonathan Jelf accompanied me. I found the direction of the great East Anglian line, represented by a party of some 12 or 14 gentlemen, seated in solemn conclave round a huge green table in a gloomy boardroom adjoining the London terminus. Being courteously received by the chairman, who at once began by saying that certain statements of mine respecting Mr. John Dreeryhouse had come to the knowledge of the direction, and that they, in consequence, desired to confer with me on those points, we were placed at the table, and the inquiry proceeded in due form. I was first asked if I knew Mr. John Dreeryhouse, how long I had been acquainted with him, and whether I could identify him at sight. I was then asked when I had seen him last, to which I replied, on the 4th of this present month, December, 1856. Then came the inquiry of where I had seen him on the 4th day of December, to which I replied that I had met him in a first-class compartment of the 4:15 Down Express, that he got in just as the train was leaving the London terminus, that he had alighted at Blackwater Station. The chairman then inquired whether I had held any communication with my fellow traveler, whereupon I related, as nearly as I could remember it, the whole bulk and substance of Mr. John Dreeryhouse's information respecting the new branch line. To all this the board listened with profound attention, while the chairman presided and the secretary took note. I then produced the cigar case. It was passed from hand to hand and recognized by all. There was not a man present who did not remember that plain cigar case with its silver monogram, or to whom it seemed anything less than entirely corroborative of my evidence. When at length I had told all that I had to tell, the chairman whispered something to the secretary, the secretary touched a silver handbell, and the guard, Benjamin Summers, was ushered into the room. He was then examined as carefully as myself. He declared that he knew Mr. John Dreeryhouse perfectly well, that he could not be mistaken in him, that he remembered going down with the 4:15 on the afternoon in question, that he remembered me, and that, there being one or two empty first-class compartments on that special afternoon, he had, in compliance with my request, placed me in a carriage by myself. He was positive that I remained alone in that compartment all the way from London to Clayborough. He was ready to take his oath that Mr. Drury House was neither in that carriage with me nor in any compartment of that train. He remembered distinctly to have examined my ticket at Blackwater, was certain that there was no one else at that time in the carriage, could not have failed to observe a second person, if there had been one. Had that second person been Mr. John Drury House, should have quietly double-locked the door of the carriage and have at once given information to the Blackwater station manager. So clear, so decisive, so ready was Summers with this testimony that the board looked fairly puzzled.
You hear this person's statement, Mr. Langford. It contradicts yours in every particular. What have you to say in reply?
I can only repeat what I said before. I am quite as positive of the truth of my own assertions as Mr. Summers can be of the truth of his.
You say that Mr. Drury House alighted at Blackwater and that he was in possession of a private key. Are you sure that he had not alighted by means of that key before the guard came round for the tickets?
I am quite positive that he did not leave the carriage till the train had fairly entered the station and the other Blackwater passengers alighted. I even saw that he was met there by a friend.
Indeed. Did you see that person distinctly?
Quite distinctly.
Can you describe his appearance?
I think so. He was short and very slight, sandy-haired, with a bushy mustache and beard, and he wore a loosely fitting suit of gray tweed. His age, I should take to be about 38 or 40.
Did Mr. Drury House leave the station in this person's company?
I cannot tell. I saw them walking together down the platform, and then I saw them standing aside under a gas jet, talking earnestly. After that, I lost sight of them quite suddenly, and just then my train went on, and I with it. The chairman and secretary conferred together in an undertone. The directors whispered to one another. One or two looked suspiciously at the guard. I could see that my evidence remained unshaken, and that, like myself, they suspected some complicity between the guard and the defaulter.
How far did you conduct that 4:15 express on the day in question, Summers?
All through, sir, from London to Crampton.
How was it that you were not relieved at Clayborough? I thought there was always a change of guards at Clayborough.
There used to be, sir, till the new regulations came in for us last midsummer, since when the guards in charge of express trains got the whole way through. The chairman turned to the secretary.
I think it would be as well if we had the day book to refer upon this point.
Again the secretary touched the silver hand bell and desired the porter in attendance to summon Mr. Rakes. From a word or two dropped by another of the directors, I gathered that Mr. Rakes was one of the under-secretaries. He came, a small, slight, sandy-haired, keen-eyed man, with an eager, nervous manner and a forest of light beard and mustache. He just showed himself at the door of the boardroom, and being requested to bring a certain day-book from a certain shelf in a certain room, bowed and vanished. He was there just a moment, and the surprise of seeing him was so great and sudden that it was not till the door had closed upon him that I found voice to speak. He was no sooner gone, however, than I sprang to my feet. That person is the same who met Mr. Drury House upon the platform at Blackwater. There was a general movement of surprise. The chairman looked grave and somewhat agitated.
Take care, Mr. Langford. Take care what you say.
I am as positive as his identity as of my own.
Do you consider the consequences of your words? Do you consider that you are bringing a charge of the gravest character against one of the company's servants?
I am willing to be put under my oath if necessary. The man who came to that door a minute since is the same who I saw talking with Mr. Drury House on the Blackwater platform. Were he 20 times the company's servant, I would say neither more nor less. The chairman turned again to the guard.
Did you see Mr. Rakes in the train or on the platform?
Summers shook his head.
I am confident Mr. Rakes was not in the train, and I certainly did not see him on the platform.
The chairman turned next to the secretary.
Mr. Rakes is in your office, Mr. Hunter. Can you remember if he was absent on the 4th instant?
I do not think he was, but I am not prepared to speak positively. I have been away most afternoons myself lately, and Mr. Rakes might easily have absented himself if he had been disposed. At this moment, the undersecretary returned with the daybook under his arm.
Be pleased to refer Mr. Rakes to the entries of the 4th instant
and see what Mr. Benjamin Summers' duties were on that day. Mr. Rakes threw open the cumbrous volume and ran a practiced eye and finger down some three or four successive column of entries. Stopping suddenly at the foot of a page, he then read aloud that Mr. Benjamin Summers had, on that day, concluded the 4:15 express from London to Crampton. The chairman leaned forward in his seat, looked the undersecretary full in the face, and said quite sharply and suddenly,
"And where were you, Mr. Rakes, on the same afternoon?"
"I, sir?"
"You, Mr. Rakes, where were you on the afternoon and evening of the 4th of the present month?"
"Here, sir, in Mr. Hunter's office. Where else should I be?" There was a dash of trepidation in the undersecretary's voice as he said this, but his look of surprise was natural enough.
"We have some reason for believing, Mr. Rakes, that you were absent that afternoon without leave. Was this the case?"
"Certainly not, sir. I have not had a day's holiday since September. Mr. Hunter will bear me out in this."
Mr. Hunter repeated what he had previously said on the subject, but added that the clerks in the adjoining office would be certain to know, whereupon the senior clerk, a grave middle-aged person in green glasses, was summoned and interrogated. His testimony cleared the undersecretary at once. He declared that Mr. Rakes had in no instance, to his knowledge, been absent during office hours since his return from his annual holiday in September. I was confounded. The chairman turned to me with a smile in which a shade of covert annoyance was scarcely apparent.
"You hear, Mr. Langford?"
"I hear, sir, but my conviction remains unshaken."
"I fear, Mr. Langford, that your convictions are very insufficiently based. I fear that you dream dreams and mistake them for actual occurrences. It is a dangerous habit of mind and might lead to dangerous results. Mr. Rakes here would have found himself in an unpleasant position had he not proved so satisfactory an alibi."
I was about to reply, but he gave me no time.
"I think, gentlemen, that we should be wasting time to push this inquiry further. Mr. Langford's evidence would seem to be of an equal value throughout. The testimony of Benjamin Summers disproves his first statement, and the testimony of the last witness disproves the second. I think we may conclude that Mr. Langford fell asleep in the train on the occasion of his journey to Clayborough and dreamed an unusually vivid and circumstantial dream, of which, however, we have now heard quite enough."
There are few things more annoying than to find one's positive convictions met with incredulity. I could not help feeling impatient at the turn that affairs had taken. I was not proof against the civil sarcasm of the chairman's manner. Most intolerable of all, however, was the quiet smile lurking about the corners of Benjamin Summers' mouth and the half-triumphant, half-malicious gleam in the eyes of the undersecretary. The man was evidently puzzled and somewhat alarmed. His look seemed furtively to interrogate me. Who was I? What did I want? Why had I come there to do him an ill turn with his employers? What was it to me whether or not he was absent without leave? Seeing all this, and perhaps irritated by it more than the thing deserved, I begged leave to detain the attention of the board for a moment longer. Jelf plucked me impatiently by the sleeve.
"Better let the thing drop. The chairman's right enough. You dreamed it, and the less said now the better."
I was not to be silenced, however, in this fashion. I had yet something to say, and I would say it. It was to this effect that dreams were not usually productive of tangible results, and that I requested to know in what way the chairman conceived I had evolved from my dream so substantial and well-made a delusion as the cigar case which I had had the honor to place before him at the commencement of our interview.
"The cigar case, I admit, Mr. Langford, is a very strong point in your evidence. It is your only strong point, however, and there's just a possibility that we may be all misled by a mere accidental resemblance. Will you permit me to see the case again?"
It is unlikely that any other should bear precisely this monogram, and yet be in all other particulars exactly similar. The chairman examined it for a moment in silence and then passed it to Mr. Hunter. Mr. Hunter turned it over and over and shook his head.
"This is no mere resemblance. It is John Dreary House's cigar case, to a certainty.
I remember it perfectly. I have seen it 100 times.
I believe I may say the same, yet how account for the way in which Mr. Langford asserts that it came into his possession?
I can only repeat that I found it on the floor of the carriage after Mr. Dreeryhouse had alighted. It was in leaning out to look after him that I trod upon it, and it was running after him for the purpose of restoring it that I saw, or believed I saw, Mr. Rake standing aside with him in earnest conversation. Again, I felt Jonathan Jelf plucking at my sleeve.
Look at Rakes! Look at Rakes!
I turned to where the undersecretary had been standing a moment before and saw him, white as death, with lips trembling and livid, stealing toward the door. To conceive a sudden, strange, and indefinite suspicion, to fling myself in his way, to take him by the shoulders as if he were a child, and turn his craven face perforce toward the board, were with me the work of an instant.
Look at him! Look at his face! I ask no better witness to the truth of my words.
The chairman's brow darkened.
Mr. Rakes, if you know anything, you'd better speak.
Vainly trying to wrench himself from my grasp, the undersecretary stammered out an incoherent denial.
Let me go! I know nothing. You have no right to detain me. Let me go!
Did you or did you not meet Mr. John Dreeryhouse at Blackwater Station? The charge brought against you is either true or false. If true, you would do well to throw yourself upon the mercy of the board and make full confession of all that you know.
The undersecretary wrung his hands in an agony of helpless terror.
I was away. I was 200 miles away at the time. I know nothing about it. I have nothing to confess. I'm innocent. I call God to witness I am innocent.
200 miles away? What do you mean?
I was in Devonshire. I had 3 weeks' leave of absence. I appealed to Mr. Hunter. Mr. Hunter knows I had 3 weeks' leave of absence. I was in Devonshire all the time. I can prove I was in Devonshire.
Seeing him so abject, so incoherent, so wild with apprehension, the directors began to whisper gravely among themselves, while one got quietly up and called the porter to guard the door.
What has your being in Devonshire to do with the matter? When were you in Devonshire?
Mr. Rakes took his leave in September, about the time when Mr. Dreeryhouse disappeared.
I never even heard he had disappeared till I came back.
That must remain to be proved. I shall at once put this matter in the hands of the police. In the meanwhile, Mr. Rakes, being myself a magistrate and used to deal with these cases, I advise you to offer no resistance, but to confess while confession may yet do you service. As for your accomplice,
the frightened wretch fell upon his knees.
I had no accomplice. Only have mercy upon me. Only spare my life, and I will confess all. I didn't mean to harm him. I didn't mean to hurt a hair of his head. Only have mercy on me and let me go.
The chairman rose in his place, pale and agitated.
Good heavens, what horrible mystery is this? What does it mean?
As sure as there is a God in heaven, it means that murder has been done.
No! No! No!
Shrieked Rakes, still upon his knees and cowering like a beaten hound.
Not murder! No jury that ever sat could bring it in murder. I thought I'd only stunned him. I never meant to do him more than stun him. Manslaughter! Manslaughter! Not murder!
Overcome by the horror of this unexpected revelation, the chairman covered his face with his hand and for a moment or two remained silent.
Miserable man, you have betrayed yourself.
You made me confess! You urge me to throw myself upon the mercy of the board.
You have confessed to a crime which no one suspected you have committed, and which this board has no power either to punish or forgive. All that I can do for you is to advise you to submit to the law, to plead guilty, and to conceal nothing. When did you do this deed?
The guilty man rose to his feet and leaned heavily against the table. His answer came reluctantly, like the speech of one dreaming.
On the 22nd of September.
On the 22nd of September? I looked in Jonathan Jelf's face, and he in mine. I felt my own paling with a strange sense of wonder and dread. I saw him blanch suddenly, even to the lips.
Merciful heaven, what was it then
that you saw in the train. What was it then that I saw in the train? The question remains unanswered to this day. I've never been able to reply to it. I only know that it bore the living likeness of the murdered man, whose body had then been lying some 10 weeks under a rough pile of branches and brambles and rotting leaves at the bottom of a deserted chalk pit about halfway between Blackwater and Mallingford. I know that it spoke and moved and looked as that man spoke and moved and looked in life, that I had heard or seemed to hear things related which I could never have known otherwise, that I was guided, as it were, by that vision on the platform to the identification of the murderer, and that, a passive instrument myself, I was destined, by means of these mysterious teachings, to bring about the ends of justice. For these things I have never been able to account. As for that matter of the cigar case, it proved on inquiry that the carriage in which I traveled down that afternoon to Clayborough had not been in use for several weeks, and was, in point of fact, the same in which poor John Dreeryhouse had performed his last journey. The case had doubtless been dropped by him, and in lain unnoticed till I found it. Upon the details of the murder I have no need to dwell. Those who desire more ample particulars may find them, and the written confession of Augustus Rakes, in the files of the Times for 1856. Enough that the Under-Secretary, knowing the history of the new line, and following the negotiation step by step through all its stages, determined to waylay Mr. Dreeryhouse, rob him of the £75,000, and escape to America with his booty. In order to effect these ends, he obtained leave of absence a few days before the time appointed for the payment of the money, secured his passage across the Atlantic in a steamer, advertised a start on the 23rd, provided himself with a heavily loaded life preserver, and went down to Blackwater to await the arrival of his victim. How he met him on the platform with a pretended message from the board, how he offered to conduct him by a shortcut across the fields to Mallingford, how, having brought him to a lonely place, he struck him down with the life preserver, and so killed him, and how, finding what he had done, he dragged the body to the verge of an out-of-the-way chalk pit, and there flung it in and piled it over with branches of brambles, are facts still fresh in the memories of those who, like the connoisseurs of De Quincey's famous essay, regard murder as a fine art. Strangely enough, the murderer, having done his work, was afraid to leave the country. He declared that he had not intended to take the director's life, but only to stun and rob him, and that, finding the blow had killed him, he dared not fly for fear of drawing down suspicion upon his own head. As a mere robbery, he would have been safe in the States, but as a murderer, he would inevitably have been pursued and given up to justice. So he forfeited his passage, returned to the office as usual at the end of his leave, and locked up his ill-gotten thousands till a more convenient opportunity. In the meanwhile, he had the satisfaction of finding that Mr. Dreeryhouse was universally believed to have absconded with the money. No one knew how or whither. Whether he meant murder or not, however, Mr. Augustus Rakes paid the full penalty of his crime and was hanged at the Old Bailey in the second week of January, 1857. Those who desire to make his further acquaintance may see him any day, admirably done in wax, in the Chamber of Horrors at Madame Tussaud's exhibit in Baker Street. He is there to be found in the midst of a select society of ladies and gentlemen of atrocious memory, dressed in the close-cut tweed suit which he wore on the evening of the murder, and holding in his hand the identical life preserver with which he committed it. The end. And so ends the popular tale, The 415 Express. I hope you enjoyed this story as much as I did. More information about Amelia Edwards, her travels, and her other stories can be found in the show notes. Thank you for tuning into this episode of Wildflower Tales. Please subscribe for upcoming episodes where we will uncover more hidden treasures from women of literature. Until next time, this is your host, Jenny Dallin, signing off. And just like wildflowers, may you thrive in unexpected places.